Well, here is John Taylor Gatto.
You'll probably notice before very long that I'm working from a script. I want you to know that I could throw this script away, bar those doors, and I could speak to you all night long. But this script is to protect you. When I originally spoke with Sarah, it was my intention to come up here and make a presentation from the book that I'm completing now called Weapons of Mass Instruction. But somehow or other, I forgot that we had made that arrangement. And so you're going to get a different presentation, but I'll give you a sample of what I mean by weapons of mass instruction. Those are very, very precise tools buried into the structure of schooling that prevent the development of imagination in particular, intellect, initiative. I know that sounds conspiratorial. It's not intended to be. And I'd like to justify temporarily the people who gave us this form of instruction of the young. Without any exception at all from the intellectual community, the idea of education itself for the last 500 years has been worse than sneered at by major intellectuals. They simply claim that it's impossible, that it can't take place. And I'd like to just briefly walk you through a few of those, even though that was not my intention when I sat down up here. But I think that rather than just being some raving lunatic from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I'll show you what the hidden foundation of my own research has been. In the 16th century, a major theological figure, John Calvin, whose influence still is all over Canada and the United States and most of the world, wrote an enormous book called Institutes of the Christian Religions, four really large volumes. And since Calvin was a first-class legal mind, not initially a theologian, it's written with this tremendous intellectual rigor. In it, Calvin says that you've heard the idea of predestination, but here are some of its implications. Calvin says that since the unfolding of human society and human life was known before the possibility existed, that most of the people born and who live on this planet are doomed, and there's no possible way for them to redeem themselves. They're doomed to eternal torment. Now, notice that the original Christian idea, which we would call the Catholic idea today, is sin and redemption. But at the core of Calvinist predestination, which had an immense influence, certainly on this part of the world, perhaps the most important influence was this idea, the vast mass of the population could not be redeemed whatever they did. Notice what that does to the idea of education. And suspiciously, I think, where we get the very first forced schooling laws is straight out of the Calvinist community. They couldn't actually make those laws work, but they passed the laws and tried to make them work. But they had no intention of accepting the idea that some child of the damned, himself or herself damned, could be redeemed. Now, I know that you're all modern Canadians, and you say, well, we don't think that way anymore. Okay. In 1670, perhaps one of the three or four most potent philosophers in modern history, Benedict Spinoza. I know that he's carried in the library as Baruch Spinoza. He never signed his name Baruch Spinoza, but always Benedict. Benedict Spinoza, known in the university community as a liberal thinker, actually said that almost every, notice the connection I'm about to show you between him and Calvin, although Spinoza was rabidly anti-religious. Spinoza said that the vast majority of the human race is permanently irrational and dangerous. And that the only way, 1670 is the book, it's Tractatus Religico Politicus. That's the name of the book, and I'll bet you it'll be in the public library system of Ottawa, and certainly in the university system. In Tractatus, Spinoza said to the reigning heads of European governments, and he was intensely read by the founders of the United States, he said that because of this permanent disability of irrationality, some way had to be found to bind the common population, fill its head with illusions, destroy its ability to imagine, which is what really made it dangerous. In other words, he created the clear idea and purpose for institutional public schooling. If you ever read Thomas Jefferson, who's a wonderful American figure, Jefferson said that schooling would be a mere civil religion. So I knew he had read Spinoza, because civil religion is what Spinoza intended to create to replace inspirational religion. Civil religion. School would be a civil religion. And Jefferson said, school has only five justifications. To teach people their rights is first and foremost, and to teach them how to defend their rights is an essential reciprocal of that, because if you know your rights and don't know how to defend them, they're simply an abstraction. Then he said it would be justified if it taught useful knowledge, such as building a house, building a boat, making clothing, growing food, etc., etc. If it taught an ever-present skepticism against expertise, because Jefferson knew that the Greeks had scorn for specialists and experts, believing that anyone who was crazy enough to unbalance their life that way might be useful in limited situations, but clearly they had bad judgment and probably were dishonest there. So it was to teach experts to stay in their places because they would have bad judgment. And finally, it was to know the ways of the human heart so well that you could neither be cheated nor fooled. And Jefferson said, if schools don't teach those five things, they're a mere civil religion, plugging into Spinoza's fervent hope for schooling, that it would replace religion. So now I've taken you from Calvin, intensely God-soaked, to Spinoza, so purely atheistic that he was pitched out of his synagogue and they said, don't come back. But I can go a little bit farther than that, and I really should. The major intellectual thinker who ended the idea, the romantic idea, that ordinary people could be educated was Charles Darwin. Now, I understand that everyone sitting here believes that they have a pretty fair idea of what Darwin had on his mind, but I urge you to read a book published in North America in 1871 called Descent of Man. I know you're all familiar with Origin of Species, which is 1859, but his really potent book came out in 1871, in which Darwin said that evolution wasn't occupying all the creatures on Earth, but only a small fraction of them were evolving, and everybody else was just dead weight, was evolutionarily retarded. And now get ready for the big breakthrough that electrified management circles all over North America and the European world, and as far away as Japan. Darwin said that if the evolutionarily retarded, who are about 19 people out of 20, intermarried with the good stuff, evolution would march backwards into the swirling mists of the dawnless past. In other words, if you are a responsible person of some social clout, it was your job to keep the bad stuff away from the good stuff, and the bad stuff outnumbered the good stuff 19 to 1. Here, Calvin's idea and Spinoza's idea suddenly got scientific justification. And the idea that you would cloud the minds of the evolutionarily retarded through an institution of mass schooling had real ethical and moral justification. You were simply enhancing the forward march of evolution. You won't have learned this. I don't mean this in any way as a criticism of the University of Ottawa, but you will not have learned this in any class at the University of Ottawa from 1890 until through the 1920s, through the 1930s, actually. At major universities, there were classes that taught a seminar elite, handpicked by the professor, how to take charge of evolution and guide it efficiently. In the United States, and perhaps in Canada too, the movement was called Bionomics. About 6 years ago, I got an invitation from the Libertarian Cato Institute to make a talk in San Francisco at the Mark Hopkins Hotel at the sixth annual Bionomics Conference. To say that the hair stood up on my head. But, you know, anyway, so what Bionomics was about was keeping the bad stuff from getting in the way of the good stuff. And the first president of Stanford University, David Starr Jordan, was the star bionomical expert of the world, and he selected Elwood P. Cubberley, his star pupil in bionomics, to be the first dean of education at Stanford University. And if you pick up a copy of a very, very scholarly textbook, not conspiracy data, but that's used in graduate schools of education, David Tyack is the author. It's called Managers of Virtue, about the founders of forced schooling. In Canada, your big name is Edgerton Ryerson, who was a good friend of Horace Mann down in the States. But in both places, the principal figures were bionomically trained, so that the massive data is really overwhelming. It's simply that none of it, all of it is accessible, but how could it be accessible unless you knew that this was a driving theme in modern Western life, but particularly in the United States and Canada, because we had more energy than the rest of the world. I don't have any trouble ad-libbing. This has nothing to do with the... No, it does. It does. Because some of the things I'll say in the talk, you might wander out here and say, what is he, nuts? There. I just want to give you one more name. Psychology, which is certainly one of the major profit pictures in the whole university world these days, was a minor branch of philosophy until the laboratories of a fellow named Wilhelm Wundt at the University of Leipzig got up and running in the slightly after the middle of the 19th century, and sons of the wealthy from all over the world, but particularly from the United States and Canada, went to Germany to study at the University of Berlin, and particularly to study under Wilhelm Wundt a bit at Leipzig. And Wundt taught that most everybody was, in fact, a flesh and blood machine, but that most of those machines were defective and could not be corrected. They could be adjusted temporarily. That's where the word adjustment comes from. But they would always go out of adjustment again and again. So ways had to be found, social technological ways found to keep the bad machinery from messing up the good machinery. These are the major things, and there's lots, lots more. There's no one, in fact, who stands counter to this. So this is how we got universal forced schooling. Obviously, there was a widespread impulse to be literate and to learn to use your mind the way you could see the more successful people used your mind. But that was taken advantage of by social engineers working in the interests of this grand intellectual scheme. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed at all. This impulse is just much, much more better organized, and technology allows the surveillance of each one of you. I mean, while you're sitting here, I've had cookies planted in your computers that are studying every movement you make. So I call this talk originally Weapons of Mass Instruction. I want to tell you where the idea came from. I got an award from a foundation, I think 4 years ago in Washington, D.C. And when I went down there to get it, there were other people receiving the same award. And one of them was an 11-year-old Chinese immigrant boy named Andrew Su, T-S-U, from the Seattle area, 11 years old. He was getting his award for having sequenced genes held in common between mice and human beings. So I looked down at Andrew, who just was a little slip of a guy, and I said, How did you get interested in sequencing mouse genes, Andrew? Now, you would think that he was the son of some holders of university chairs, but in fact, he was the son of waiters. I mean, menials in the American economic system. His first language wasn't English. He was from Taiwan. And he had won the Washington State Science Fair. Not the school science fair, the Washington State Science Fair with his gene sequencing. So we were getting, and I said, okay, so how come you weren't playing baseball? And he said, my grandfather told me a story when I was little. Mind you, this is an 11-year-old kid saying this to me. But you're about to hear about 4-year-old kids in a few minutes. But this 11-year-old kid said, when I was little, my grandfather taught me how to train fleas. Now, oddly enough, I knew a lot about trained fleas. I mean, when I came to New York City from Pittsburgh back in the early 1950s, there actually was a flea circus on 42nd Street and Broadway. You had to get down 2 stories under the street. It was called Hubert's Flea Circus. And by God, for a quarter, Hubert would stick his arm out and feed the fleas first. And then they would swing on trapezes. They would draw little chariots. They would fence with swords. It was just uncanny. So I had a brief affection for trained fleas, and I discovered that in all the great courts of Asia, and some of them in Europe, you weren't anybody unless you had trained fleas. So what did Andrew teach me about trained fleas that I didn't know? He said, you can't train fleas until you break their will. Okay. How do you break a flea's will, Andrew? He said, if you fill a Petri dish, you know, one of those little shallow dishes used in chemistry and biology and things, if you fill a Petri dish with fleas, they will instantly jump out and head off in every direction because they have an agenda of their own. He said, but to eliminate their personal agendas, you put a lid on the Petri dish and you go away for 2 hours. When you come back, they've hurt themselves so badly leaping to get out of the dish and never being able to budge that lid an inch, that when you take the lid off, picture this in your head, because this is life-changing, not one of the fleas will try to get out of the dish. He said, now they're in a state where they can be trained. Instantly upon him finishing that sentence, I knew what I had been hired to do for 30 years. I was the lid on that dish. And as long as I and my colleagues could frustrate the personal agendas often enough, very few of them, if any, would survive. And they then could be conditioned to the purposes of, let's say, management. Let's call it management. So I saw that one of the prime weapons of mass instruction was this ability to frustrate individual initiative. Then, this is almost the equivalent of that story. A couple of months after that, I got a letter from the publishers of a horse magazine in Frankfort, Kentucky, called the Equine Mental Health Journal. Now, I thought I had heard everything, but I didn't know it was a journal of horses' mental health. And they had marked an article that they thought I might find interesting. So I read the article. It was about the destructive psychological effects on a horse of being kept in a stall and then only having like a small outdoor area to run in and never enough room to run with a herd of horses. And when I looked at the list of characteristics that these horses put off, that they balked at learning, that they couldn't project a stable personality, and so the whole list I could match with effects that I had seen over and over again in the classroom, and I just attributed to bad biology or bad sociology. So that restricting the space in which a person learns about themselves and about the world, and then keeping the horse, as they said, away from the wisdom of the herd, produces this set of pathologies that you could use if you wished to exclude these horses from any serious competition. So I realized that this was another weapon of mass instruction. And then I began, once that line of reasoning was alive in my mind, I wrote The Seven Lesson School Teacher in Dumbing Us Down, which is a book Sarah said. And that was 12 years ago, and I've now amassed, without straining at all, a large number of weapons of mass instruction, so large and so persistent that they could not happen by accident. They could happen by accident, but they would be self-correcting as people saw the bad effects they produced. And that triggered an intense interest in finding out where this school institution had come from, why it took the shape it took, how it has managed to persist in the face of periodic waves of disgust and public criticism, and always to grow larger, more expensive, and more time-consuming of the limited resources.